You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, after the most expensive judicial race in American history, liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz was sworn in earlier this month to Wisconsin's Supreme Court, giving liberals a 4-3 majority and ending 15 years of conservative control. The opening days of the new court have been rocky. The new liberal majority stripped some powers from conservative Chief Justice Annette Ziegler and fired the state director of courts. Ziegler has called those actions, quote, nothing short of a coup, and said she would consider suing. Meanwhile, Republican state lawmakers have said they would consider impeaching Protasiewicz if she doesn't recuse herself from cases addressing abortion and redistricting, citing comments she made on the campaign trail. We're talking about Wisconsin's state Supreme Court, which just this month gained a liberal majority for the first time in a decade and a half. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see from this court? Do you think Justice Protasiewicz should recuse herself on cases involving issues she talked about during the campaign, especially redistricting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Chad Oldfather is a professor at Marquette University Law School. He specializes in constitutional law and the judicial system. He's writing a book tentatively titled Judges, Judging, and Judgment, The Importance of Judicial Character in a Polarized World. Chad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with this idea of recusal based on comments on the campaign trail. Justice Protasiewicz had called Wisconsin's election maps rigged. We're expecting to see redistricting go to the state Supreme Court. Republican lawmakers are saying she should take herself off that case, floating the idea of impeachment if she doesn't. How does this fit into our standards for recusal in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. And with all of these issues surrounding the state Supreme Court, there are a lot of moving pieces involved. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of recusal and how it relates to statements on the campaign trail, things are a bit complex, right? So the basic idea behind judicial recusal, of course, is centered on the notion of impartiality. And that's a phrase that is often kicked around, but not so often precisely defined. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case in 2002, struck down Minnesota's ethics code's prohibition on judicial candidates there making statements about issues, their positions on issues that were likely to come up when they were, if they were elected. Saying that really didn't protect the kind of impartiality that's at issue here, that the impartiality that's being guaranteed is really more just of a general open-mindedness, right? That you wouldn't want people as judges or justices who didn't have any views on legal issues. That would actually be a bad thing. So it's no surprise that people are going to have those issues. And that leaves us in this sort of difficult situation where it becomes often a matter of degree, how much of a statement is too much of a statement. So that's one aspect of the problem that's in front of us right now, but it's really hardly the only one.
Then there's these emails came out from earlier this month with this change in control of the court to the liberal majority, members of that majority firing a person in a key position. A lot of bickering in this email. We've got a polarized court and a lot of personal differences on the court. I don't know. I don't think this is how people expect Supreme Court justices to get along with each other. What's going on?
Yeah, this is not how they draw it up, certainly. And, you know, this is a story I think that has a bit of a long lead in. You know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has had a little bit of a contentious history, I think, going back probably at this point 3 decades. You know, there was a time in the 90s, I don't remember the exact dates, but when then Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson was running for re-election and was openly opposed by some of her colleagues on the court. And I think there's always been, and it's, you know, a lot of the time been under the surface, but there's been this sense that, you know, the interpersonal dynamics among the justices haven't always been great. There was, of course, the incident involving, you know, the conflict, the physical conflict between Justices Prosser and Anne Walsh Bradley, you know, at this point, probably 10, 15 years ago, that took place, right? So there's always been a sense that, you know, at least beneath the surface, things were not going so smoothly. That has obviously become much more public lately. And I think it's tied in not only with the history of interpersonal dynamics on the court, but as the state's political culture has become increasingly polarized, that seems to have affected the court. Because of course, the campaigns that we've all seen unfolding in the last several election cycles for the state Supreme Court look more and more like political campaigns. And, you know, that probably has all sorts of ripple effects from, you know, not only encouraging candidates to make statements as candidates that they might not otherwise make, and probably, you know, discouraging a lot of the people who we might want to have be judges from even considering the prospect, because who wants to put themselves through that?
You mentioned these arguments, these internal procedural arguments going to the public. Here's Chief Justice Annette Ziegler on the conservative Dan O'Donnell show reacting to some of the moves from the new liberal majority.
It's nothing short of a coup, really. I hope that they do come to their senses. I am hoping that they will retract what it is that they've done. I fear that they won't, though, because this does seem to be a situation where I don't know any other reason why they would do this other than to try to maybe get cases that they think deserve preferential treatment to the front of the line.
So conflict over, again, some of the procedural things behind the court, a lot of appointments and things like that. Does it surprise you to hear that out in the public eye like that?
It does, yeah. I mean, it's not it's not what we traditionally expect from the judiciary, right? I mean, ideally, and you know, you mentioned in the introduction the book that I'm working on, you know, the ideal of the judge or justice that I have in mind is really someone who isn't in the public eye, right? It's, you know, judges are often analogized to sports officials, and the roles are parallel in lots of respects. And one of the things you often hear is nobody goes to the game to watch the officials, right? We want them to do their job, and to, in a sense, otherwise be sort of invisible. And that's traditionally how it is, right? The judiciary kind of, you know, deals with matters internally, and we haven't historically seen these things often, at least coming out into the public like this. Now, I will say, I don't think Wisconsin is entirely unique in this. We are in all sorts of ways kind of paralleled by North Carolina. And I think things with their state Supreme Court have, you know, there have been some similar dynamics going on, maybe not quite as dramatic as what we're seeing here. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but it is very rare, to say the least.
Talking to Chad Oldfather, professor at Marquette University Law School, looking at the latest out of Wisconsin State Supreme Court conflict with the new look in the court boiling over into the public. Calls from some Republicans that the newest justice, Janet Protasiewicz, should recuse herself, especially from redistricting cases based on comments she made during the campaign earlier this year. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for taking my call. So my main point is just that I think that some of the comments and the calls for recusal on certain cases are sort of just absurd, especially considering, as the guest alluded to earlier, the fact that it's sort of silly to expect that a elected judicial official would not have stances or opinions about legal issues. And even furthermore, considering, and I say this having canvassed for Justice Protasiewicz, that abortion and redistricting have been and continue to be such important issues for so many Wisconsin voters. And yeah.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. And Chad, that's something, like when I interview state Supreme Court candidates before elections, it's always tough because people want to know, how are you going to vote on abortion or redistricting or things like that? Or at least, what are your perspectives on it? And the expectation is they don't talk about those things. I don't know. What do you think of Michael's thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's so this is truly an interesting recusal situation. And it is very much tied up with the fact that we have judicial elections, which raises that dynamic that you just alluded to. Right. So the traditional recusal is in a case involving private parties. And usually when we're talking about campaign funding, it has a different twist to it. And let me talk about it in terms of the case Caperton versus Massey, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that that established this idea that large campaign donations can establish a constitutional grounds for essentially requiring someone to recuse. And what was going on in that case is you have essentially an individual claimant saying, this most recent justice elected to the West Virginia Supreme Court was elected in large part as a result of the excessive spending of essentially my opponent in this case, right? It was the CEO and owner of the company that he was in litigation against. And that donation, you know, didn't take place openly, right? It wasn't the case that if you were a voter in the state of West Virginia, you could easily see what was going on. The money was run through an organization that, if I'm remembering correctly, was called And for the Sake of the Children, right? Which, so it's this interest group that's set up that that is meant to benefit one candidate and purports, you know, in name at least, to be about protecting kids, which had nothing to do with the particular case involved, right? So there's this sort of beneath the surface aspect to the campaign donation in that case that really isn't present here. Because the striking thing here is everybody understands exactly what the comments related to. And, you know, one could say that this, you know, that the legislature here, right, what is the legislature supposed to be other than the voice of the people? And if the people themselves have, in effect, ratified these statements, have said, this is what we want, well, that certainly adds a different twist to the claims that somebody's due process rights are being violated, because ultimately the holder of the due process right here would be the people, you know, in the form of the legislature. So it's a different dynamic. And, you know, I don't know that necessarily resolves the question, but it certainly changes the question from what arises in the traditional recusal situation.
We're talking to Marquette University Law School professor Chad Oldfather about how the state Supreme Court is doing, some friction there after a switch from conservative to liberal control. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What qualities do you want to see in a judge, especially in the highest court in the state? What are your thoughts on how politics have affected the judicial system? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Marquette University Law School professor Chad Oldfather about how the state Supreme Court is doing at the beginning of the new liberal majority's tenure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Excellent. Well, I think I read a piece where Professor Oldfather was quoted earlier today, and I seem to understand that if the Assembly votes to impeach Justice Protasiewicz and the Senate refuses to hold a trial, then the seat on the court is going to be held effectively vacant for as long as the legislature wants. And I mean, and just given the substance of the situation, that this is a legislature that continually returns to office regardless of whether it gets a majority of the vote or not, how likely is this to happen? And if it does happen, what recourse is there?
Elise, thanks for the call. Chad.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, you know, one so much of this is uncharted territory, right? These are just things that really haven't happened. Impeachment, you know, thankfully has not been something that's happened a lot in Wisconsin. It's not been something that's happened a lot nationwide. And so a lot of the questions are unanswered. But as the caller points out, right, there is this twist in the state constitution insofar as it provides that the assembly has the impeachment power. And if a judicial officer is impeached, that person may not hear cases until they have been acquitted, unless and until they've been acquitted after a trial by the Senate. And of course, the Constitution doesn't speak to when or how quickly that trial has to take place, right? And so what you could see would be something akin to what happened when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland for the U.S. Supreme Court, which was the Senate just didn't act on it. In a situation like that, then the question becomes, is there any one or any entity that can make them act on it? And the answer is often not really. A lot of times with respect to impeachment, the ultimate source of discipline is at the ballot box. So you could end up assuming, right, there's the whole political calculus involved in deciding whether to go forward with impeachment at all, because, you know, there may be costs associated with that. But if they do, if people want to play hardball the way a lot of the ball has been played in the state of Wisconsin lately, then that is certainly a possibility that's out there. And a question then would be, I'm sure that Justice Protasiewicz would think through, you know, is, do I have any ability to go to federal court to try to get a federal court to force things to move along here? And, you know, it's not obvious to me that there's a federal claim there. And, you know, just stating it generally, federal courts are pretty reluctant to tell states how to run their business. So, you know, these situations often, you know, end in kind of an ugly fashion, like this one may well end.
Thanks for the call. Elise, Sandra is with us now in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hi.
Hi. Because for many years, the conservative justices have allowed such lopsided redistricting, not allowing a majority of the people to be heard. The amoeba suit districts are so unfair that the Republicans stay in power without the majority of the votes. Now, we vote for our justices, and we vote for what they say they want to do. That's what she received a healthy majority of the vote because of what she was saying. That's what the people want.
Sandra, thanks for the call. Chad, that lines up with one possible argument you were laying out earlier, that her statements, as Sandra suggests, could be seen as being vindicated by the voters themselves.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, another aspect of the situation that her comment brings out is that, you know, that one thing that's striking is that any given justice on the state Supreme Court has been elected statewide, which is not, of course, true of any member of the legislature or even, you know, a majority of the members of the legislature. Right. They're elected in much smaller geographical areas by a much smaller pool of voters. Right. So in a sense, you have this ability for justices to say, I represent the will of the people in a more direct way than a member of the legislature or even, you know, some subset of the legislature does. Now, that to say that sounds awfully political, and that sounds inconsistent with them having a power that is a judicial power in nature. And I think, you know, ultimately that's right, but it does point up the fact that state Supreme Court justices being elected certainly, you know, has to have something to do with or affect the nature of their power, the power that the court has, and including with respect to things, I think, like election maps, right? It just, you know, federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court a couple years ago said basically, we cannot, as a matter of federal constitutional law, use our judicial power to intervene in partisan gerrymandering disputes. But for them to have said that, in my view, does not necessarily entail that state courts can't, because the nature of the state court's power is probably different. And certainly when they've been elected, it seems like there's a compelling case for it being different.
Thanks for that call. Chad, in our last minute and a half or so, there's a perception, I think, that our courts are particularly polarized now, U.S. Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, that it's worse, it's more polarized than in the past. Is there something to that, or are we just kind of having a golden age idea that, oh, things used to be better?
Well, I mean, I think there are two answers to that question. Partly it depends on how far back you want to look. I mean, you know, everyone has always understood to some degree or other that, you know, that politics and law are not completely divorced, and that judges vary from one to the next in terms of how they're likely to vote, and that those differences among them are often correlated with politics. And that's no surprise. I think, you know, it is different now in the sense that, you know, it used to be the case, let's say 30, 40 years ago, that the political parties were not as polarized as they are, right? So that a Republican president would appoint justices to the Supreme Court who might be considered liberal and vice versa. One of the things I do in one of my classes is we look back at the confirmation hearings for Robert Bork, whose nomination, of course, failed in 1987. And one thing that's striking about that is you have, for example, a Democratic senator from Alabama asking questions. You have a pro-choice Republican asking questions, things that now are just unheard of. So I think that political polarization has resulted in more judicial polarization. And so, you know, at least as compared to 30, 40, 50 years ago, things are worse.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
That's Chad Oldfather, professor at Marquette University Law School. He talks to us today about the new liberal majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and tensions within the court revealed by emails and public statements. You can follow news on that at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, meet a Wisconsin dairy farmer who's working to boost sustainability on the farm. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to the 2020 census, the population of Americans aged 65 and older saw its largest ever 10-year numeric gain, an increase of 15.5 million people from 2010 to 2020. That group also had its fastest growth rate of any decade since the 1880s, largest ever percentage point increase relative to the rest of the population. If that trend is sounding familiar, you may have heard the term silver tsunami. The baby boom generation started turning 65 back in 2011. As a result, the demand for senior services has been steadily increasing. At the same time, there's a growing need for training and recruiting workers for senior living and other services for older adults. The national trade group Argentum, which works with companies that own and operate senior living communities, forecasts that by 2040, there will be 3 million job openings for senior living. A program that started at UW-Eau Claire is working to meet the need for workers in senior services, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is that you? Do you work or have you worked in some form of senior care or services? What led you into that line of work? What kind of training did you have? Did the pandemic impact your employment at all? And did you leave that line of work? And what questions do you have about getting into professional senior care of any kind? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug Olson is president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services. For more than two decades, he was with UW-Eau Claire's nationally recognized healthcare administration program and director of the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
And Shayana Vanale is also with us. Shayana is currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire while working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. She's a member of the Vision Center Advisory Council. Shay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Doug, take us back to the start of this healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire. What problem were you trying to solve?
Well, the healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire has been around since 1976 and was a very solid program, one of the few in the state for sure and in the country We had kind of a big shift around 2000. The godfather of the program, Gene Decker, did a great job running it for many years. But then we took it to a different level, and we formed what you mentioned before, this thing called CHASE, the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. And that program was really all about bridging providers and the university together to kind of work on really making it a solid program for students aspiring to be looking for a career in aging services leadership. And that's really been our focus.
And then here we are in 2023, Doug. What are some of the biggest challenges in bringing people into this line of work?
Well, we actually had done a lot of things at Eau Claire that we're kind of using to move forward with this new vision center. One of the things that we kind of really emphasized was the importance of that field experience administrative training program that allows people to go out after their time on the campus with solid curriculum and then moving to a place where they can learn the practice and the trade of leading organizations that are taking care of people's parents and grandparents. And that significant shift was we also mandated that it would be a paid experience so we could get the very best talent to do the work and learn the practice of senior living administration and do exceptional things around providing the best quality and services possible for those individuals living or needing to live in a setting or requiring services too, because the spectrum has changed a ton over the years, Rob.
And Shay, let's bring you in. What made you want to study to prepare for a job in senior living and care?
Honestly, it is not what I came into college looking for. I was a bio pre-med major, and I feel like a lot of times in high school, you kind of get two options. If you want to be in healthcare and you want to help people, you can be a doctor or a nurse. So I was like, okay, I like kids. I'm going to be a pediatrician. And then by second semester, I was kind of feeling the weight of the student loans were not going away, and I still had 8 to 12 more years of school before I could start paying those down. So I was sitting in my chemistry class the first week, and this kid next to me was like, I'm an HCAD, and I'm taking this class for fun. And I'm like, okay, well, I hate chemistry, so you're weird for taking this class for fun, because that is not me. But tell me more about HCAD. And so he told me a little bit more, and I loved the fact that they said it was a heart for caring and a head for business. So I went back to my dorm room, joined HCAD 101, and within 2 weeks, I had switched my major and also joined the student org on campus and tracked Doug down and begged him to give me an internship.
Hey, HCAD, Healthcare Administration. Shay, what is it? You're also doing some work as a caregiver now. What would you say to people who, you know, maybe that line of work isn't on their radar about what a fulfilling line of work it could be?
I'd say just give it a shot. I definitely had the same fears as many people do have that senior living homes are kind of smelly and scary and dark. And just getting inside of them, whether it's visiting a family or a friend or even volunteering, whatever you can do to get inside and realize they aren't the stigma that follows them, I think that really turns people's heads around and makes them double think about what senior living can offer them.
We're talking about a program that came out of UW-Eau Claire that tries to bring professionals into senior care to work in various kinds of senior care facilities. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of Vision Center, and Shay Van Ale, who is going through the program at UW-Eau Claire, working in a center herself. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in senior care yourself at any level? Love to hear your experiences, how you got into it, the challenges. Do you or your family member count on people doing these jobs? Are there enough of them out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Doug, we see a lot of lines of work saying, hey, we're not finding the staffing we need. We have a shortage of workers. Is that particularly true in 2023 for various kinds of senior care work right now?
Yeah, that trend in all industries right now is impacting senior living as much, if not more. I think COVID really amped up the challenges in senior living, and I think there are many heroes that rose to the occasion, but it certainly has been one of those that we've really worked hard, not only through Eau Claire, but through the Vision Center, to start changing the narrative about these jobs really fulfill purpose, provide meaning, have a variety of possibilities with them. our particular focus, Rob, is all about finding good leaders, because good leaders, stable leaders, talented leaders help that culture and that workforce tremendously. And that's one of the areas that we see when you talked about the number of people that are not going to be in with positions that are unfulfilled. We estimate probably 250,000 of those jobs are in the leadership roles. So it's one of those things that at the core of what we're trying to do is not just replicate, but try to expand the landscape of senior living leadership programs across the country.
Shay, can you talk about the kind of things you're getting in your classes that are you hopefully preparing you to be a leader, maybe an administrator in senior care?
So one of the great things about the UW Eau Claire program is that during your final year that would be on campus, you are put into a long-term care facility where you are working as the assistant administrator. So for my senior year, that is what I'm doing now. And some of the things that I've learned in classes don't compare to what you see in the facilities. You can learn about the statistics and the F tags and everything all day long, but until you're in the community, talking with the residents, talking with the staff, feeling them for what they think needs to improve, the classes don't mean much once you can get that hands-on experience.
We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care, a program started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Isle, who's currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW Eau Claire and working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. And Doug Olson is with us, formerly director of UW Eau Claire's Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence, currently president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit focused on leadership development for aging services, taking some lessons from Eau Claire and sharing them around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests, either about studying to join the senior care field or addressing the workforce gap? Are you one of the baby boomers who's hoping people go into this line of work and provide some of the services you're looking for, or maybe for a family member of yours? If you work in this industry, love to hear your perspective as well. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care and a program that started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Isle, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW Eau Claire, and Doug Olson, president and CEO of Vision Center. That's a nonprofit that works on these issues, bringing lessons from Wisconsin to the rest of the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug, can you talk about the gaps you see out there and the kind of academic training, the kind of work you've done in Eau Claire and now around the country that you're trying to fill here?
Really focused around coordinating partnerships between providers and universities, providing a new narrative about the field, and also providing resources. We started this journey about 5 years ago with a sabbatical I did, bringing together all these stakeholders across the various sectors of the field. And once we got started with that, what turned out to be a project turned into momentum, and now is an initiative that is really focused around trying to bring universities to a place where they're graduating more students that are either at an undergraduate, graduate, or even a mid-career from university programs. So we started working with about 20 universities. We moved that up to about 40, and now once we launched last fall, it's been about 60. And we're working with them in a variety of ways to help them accelerate the development and growth of these programs. These are not programs, like Shay said, you know, these are not programs that someone comes into a university always and is really, it's not front and center like accounting or biology or chemistry or nursing. And so we've really tried to raise the bar around what we're doing with universities across the country. And we have done some things around assessing what early career paths people are looking for from a student perspective. We're doing some innovative stuff around field experiences. That is really what Shay talked about is the secret sauce of these programs. That's really where the hands-on learning and problem solving and really understanding how you're working with people and for people really happen. I always get a kick out of Shay saying she's learned more in 3 months in her field experience than she did on campus. But it's so critically important. And, you know, we've really worked hard. We do a symposium every year. We have webinars. We have other things that are really kind of advancing the field. And, you know, when you mention it grew out of Eau Claire, there's a lot of best practices that came from Eau Claire, but there's a lot of things we're learning as we work with other universities across the country. We're working with universities in the West, the Midwest, the East, the South, and each of them come from different kind of perspectives. Some will come out of a hospitality school, some come out of a business school, some come out of a health science school. So collectively, we're kind of all learning together and we're making great progress.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
Well, hello. I just have to tell you that I had a very, very large family. I had a lot of children of my own, but I always had wanted to be a nurse. And, of course, then it was a little too late to go to college or school to be a nurse. But I could be a nursing assistant, and I went to tech school. And I was a nursing assistant at our county nursing home for a long, long time. And I'm telling you, I loved the people that I cared for. And the thing is, it reminded me of when my dad was in a nursing home up in up north. Anyhow, I went to see him one day, and the door was closed, and knocked on the door, and a gal said, "Oh, you can't come in now. We're doing a dressing." I said, "I'm coming in. I'm a nursing assistant. I've seen it all." I had not seen it all. My father was I could see his bones in his back because obviously they had not transferred him or taken care of him and turned him and such things. And then I called the state and I told them, and they told me that they were only following doctor's orders. And I'm telling you, I never saw anything like that before. But even after I retired from our county nursing home here, I took care of so many people. I was, you know, with them when they died in their homes. And
Nancy, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks for sharing your experience. Now, Shay, I'm hearing from Nancy the value of caring if you're going into this line of work. And really, it sounds like based on her experience with her dad, she wanted to put all of herself into the care she was giving to people. How important is that, being willing to have that, I guess, that emotional vested interest in the work you're doing?
It's huge. The long-term care industry is hard. It is not easy. It's not even fun some days. And it is something that if you do not have the passion for this field, you're not going to succeed. And that's why these paid internships are so big, because it gives you the opportunity to see if this is what you want to do before you jump in. Because the residents and the staff don't deserve someone who doesn't care. And that is something that my current preceptor is huge on, is these grow-as-you-go programs where she wants the CNAs to become TMAs and RNs and LPNs and directors of nursing. She wants to encourage the passion with everyone and show them that they can be more than what they are today. If they have the passion, they can do anything in this field.
Nancy, thanks for sharing your experience. We're talking about an effort to bring more people into senior care at the highest levels and at all points. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of the group Vision Center, and Shay Van Eyl is at UW-Eau Claire studying to do this. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Doug, you and Shay have both said something along the lines of, you know, nobody goes into college thinking they're going to go into this line of work. You know, I know some fields were reaching into high school saying, hey, put this on your radar as a potential career. Is that maybe a next step?
Yeah, we are already. First of all, Nancy, I'm sorry about that one situation with your loved one. I also worked as a nursing assistant, and I would echo what Shay said. It takes passion. It's hard work. They're never paid enough for what they do, and I think society really values. During COVID, we saw how much family members and community members valued how much those staff members really contributed to the quality of life for their person. You know, one of the things that we are doing, Rob, is we are reaching into high schools and colleges to get the perspective from these new emerging leaders so that we're really talking about the profession of senior living leadership in a way that kind of resonates with, kind of away from the stigmas and the stereotypes of this is a profession that every day you make a difference for a loved one or a staff member, and you have a tremendous impact. I often say to people that the real test of a country is, you know, how they treat those that are underserved or underprivileged or frail. I think that is really the moral compass that our country really should be thinking about. And I think, you mentioned before, I mean, that silver tsunami is right there at the front door. Many people would say, why did you start this, Doug? I would say we should have started it 5 years ago. One of the things that is clear across the country is that we are definitely needing to make sure that we have people, because you talked about there'll be more people over 80 by the year 2032 than that are under 18. This is one of those kind of demographics in our country that's maturing that is really going to have to pay attention to how we do what we do. And we're going to have to do it differently. And that's why there's a lot of creative new solutions around how do we really take care of people's loved ones.
And Shay, given the time of year right now, somebody might actually be in their car getting ready to be dropped off on their campus for their freshman year. Talk directly to them, if you will, to put these careers in senior care on their radar, maybe if it's something they hadn't even thought of before.
I think it's really just about keeping your eyes open. And one of my biggest things, I was terrified to change my major and terrified to look elsewhere because I had felt like I failed. And that was not the case. If it is, I failed upwards, so I'm okay with that. But I would say just get involved. Take 101 classes that maybe aren't up your alley, but they could turn into something so much more. Be a part of the student organizations. You're not a nerd if you are. They are fun, and they help you make friends, and it helps you find where you're supposed to be. And you will find it, and you will fall in where you're supposed to be, and it is very rewarding once you get there.
And Doug, let's speak directly to another audience now. Maybe somebody's out there listening who works at or maybe even runs some kind of senior care facility, and they're not involved with Vision Center yet. Speak to them and how they can get involved.
Well, what I would tell them is that, one, they can contact me directly at dolson@visioncenter.org. And there's also, the train has left the station. There's lots of room on the train yet. And if people want to get involved, there's a variety of ways to do that, whether that's being involved and connecting with the university themselves, whether it means finding a placement for a student that wants to do an internship in this field. We really, really understand the value proposition of having someone new to the field with lots of different perspectives that really want to make a difference as a valuable asset for any senior living organization, that is, whether it's assisted living, senior housing, skilled nursing, home and community-based services. There's a broad spectrum, and we're going to need all of them. And what I will also tell, you know, the listeners is that it's also a very, very rewarding career that is got a lot of growth opportunities, and it's one of those things that I don't think you will ever look back, just like Shay said earlier.
We'll leave it there. Doug and Shay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to Doug Olson, President and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services, and Shay Van Isle, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire. We talked to them about Eau Claire's successful program, training the next generation of senior care professionals. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Get ready to can and pickle and preserve your favorite summer and fall produce. Our guest has lots of advice. You could join in with your questions or tell us your favorite things to can for the winter. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.